This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the Bristol Con Fringe reading series.
Right, and now we will press on with the Fringe properly. I would like to welcome to the Fringe for the first time Christopher Cutting, who apparently is very theatrical, so, you know, stand well back.
Thank you. I suppose I've won my approval already, have I? I don't need to do anything else, you know, I've got the applause, so thank you very much, Tom. I am very theatrical in that I am a playwright and a theatre director, and I have my own theatre company. I've put posters for my current show around just now. I've got more over here if you want to take one home, because I can't find anywhere in town that will take them. So they're yours for free. They're lovely, high-quality posters, and you never know, if I do get rich and famous and blah blah blah, then these will be worth a good deal of money. And if I don't, then you'll have a nice poster on your wall. So you're not really losing anything, are you? Right. I am a comedy writer, mostly. I've written serious things as well, but it's just never as fun. I just always want to see the funny side of everything, which is perhaps unfortunate when it comes to relationships. But I have prepared a very special story for you today that I've not performed before. It is an autobiographical story-ish. I've changed people's names. But it is very much about me and my first trip up to the Edinburgh Fringe when I was at the tender age of 21, which is, you know, years ago now, 2 years ago. No, it's 3 years ago, actually. I was 20. So there you go. I can't even remember my own life, and I wrote an autobiographical story for you all. So that's lovely. Can everyone hear me and everything?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. This is called Travels of a 19th Century Gentleman Explorer Extraordinaire. The train sailed up the east coast like a yacht in smooth and barren waters. Behind us lay the southeast of England, our well-trodden, well-known homeland, and ahead was our aim, the city of Edinburgh, and the Edinburgh Fringe, as much a new world to me back then as America was to the pioneers who discovered it. My trusty guide to this holiday would be my veteran fringe-going friend from boarding school, Barty. Real name, Bartholomew Butler Brentworth, who trooped up there every year since he was 16. After 5 consecutive years of fringing, he knew the Scottish capital like the back of his hand, so we were naturally relying on him to show us how to get everywhere we wanted to go. An invaluable service when visiting a city I now know to be initially labyrinthine, to be an initially labyrinthine mass of layers during a theatre festival whose temporary venues are found in every nook and cranny from cellars to shoe cupboards. Also on the train was my friend from university, Quentin, And awaiting our arrival in Edinburgh was his friend, Alex, a man I'd never met before, but whom Quentin described as, and I quote, an interesting character. He was joining us for the first 3 days of the festival before his parents came to collect him and take him on to wherever they were staying. So those were the four of us, Barty, Quentin, Alex and me, embarking on a cultural expedition to the largest arts festival in the world in a city I'd never experienced before. The atmosphere was alive with possibility. Sheer potential hung in the air, and excitement itself pulsed in my every breath. Disembarking from the train, we were greeted with an unnerving spectacle. In the midst of the thrumming crowd, bustling with heat and energy in the August sun, stood a stocky, runtish sort of creature, dressed in a full three-piece suit that I could see was a little too small for him, carrying several massive hiking bags. Sweat dripped liberally from the ruddy, bristly, greasy jowls of his face, and he eyed us with a sort of piggish intensity. There was something almost disturbing in his appearance. He looked like a gigantic, hairy, sweaty child. It was as if a chubby-cheeked choir boy had, instead of experiencing puberty, hideously overgrown into a short, wide adult, like a swelling fungus springing from a corpse. And it was staring straight at us. "Alex!" Quentin called, and I almost laughed, passing from incredulity to relief. After all, if this was Quentin's friend, surely he was a good guy. Don't judge a book by its cover, as the saying goes. The Q Master General would never invite anyone along who wasn't right for the holiday, would he? I thought. I'd known him for 2 terms now, and as everyone knows, freshers at university are invariably honest and open about to their new friends about all of their shortcomings at home. If this new chum of his, this Alex, wasn't up to scratch, he wouldn't have been invited, simple as that. I've been wandering around for the past hour so I know where everything is, this Alex told us. I am a geography and environmental management student, after all. I couldn't live with myself if I didn't know the terrain. Barty mentioned that he knew Edinburgh inside out as well, and Alex said, really? Smiled a closed-lipped smile and refused to meet his gaze. Was that passive aggression? Was it hiding something? What kind of introduction is that? Barty knew where our hostel was, so he took the lead, guiding us through every twist and turn of the crowded streets. However, after a couple of turns, Alex began to increase his walking pace, taking large, gregarious steps, outstripping and outmaneuvering Barty. As we came to a fork in the road, Alex turned down the wrong one, striding away from us with an air of total confidence. We stopped and called after him, Alex, it's this way! He turned around, deflated like an old balloon, and trudged back at us, seemingly chastened and bowed. However, a couple of streets later, he did the same thing again, turning down the wrong side road, marching full pelt away from us in the path to the hostel. Alex, you're going the wrong way! Each time we stood there awaiting his pleasure for at least 2 minutes. He returned to the fold again, saggier than before. I thought it was that way, he said. It wasn't, I replied. But I read the map. I'm a geography student. Have you ever been to Edinburgh before? No? Well, Barty has, and he knows where the hostel is, so we're following him. He quivered.
Yep.
Consensus had been reached. Not two streets later, he did it again. Eventually, Barty, Quentin, and I were suffered to reach and check us into the hostel. All four of us shared the same room together. Barty and I unpacked and began a jaunt down memory lane, as old boys always do. Remember that time in Upper Fifth, I said to Barty, when the organist played the Toccata and Fugue in D minor for the headmaster's procession at the end of speech day? Ha ha ha! Yes, he said. Mr. Clark came sweeping out of the chapel to in his academic robes, looking like Darth Vader with his helmet missing, and clenching his fist in righteous fury with the whole school and parents watching, I said. Best retiring organist ever. Quentin piped up. Yeah, yeah, you two with your speech days and your gold-plated boats painted in caviar and diamonds. We laughed. I wouldn't know about speech days, he said. I never had one. At this moment, Alex leaned over in Barty's and my direction and elevated himself above Quentin, a dark and mysterious look playing over his face, and gazed at the two of us conspiratorially, as if making us complicit in whatever statement was to follow this abrupt and sinister motion. We know, he said. Let me delineate my immediate mental processes upon hearing this statement. We know, I thought. We know what? I mean, we know he's state educated like Quentin, for a start, because Quentin told us earlier, so what's he trying to say? What is he trying to do? He's trying to exclude Quentin, his friend. He's trying to get in bed with Barty and me, two people he just met, and shove out his friend who invited him here. He's trying to form some kind of weird hierarchy with us above and Quentin below. He's taken several bets here. His first bet is that there's some kind of private school Illuminati, whose members presumably control world events and shroud themselves in secret rituals, like speech days and carol services, but with New World Order policies instead of the order of service. Like rigged elections instead of maths prizes, Middle Eastern oil wars instead of house sports cups, and international terrorist plots instead of singing Jerusalem. Incidentally, I can assure the reader that there most decidedly isn't. I wish there was, it'd make my life a lot easier. Knowing people who went to school with you is not a conspiracy to control the world, any more than knowing people from work or knowing your relatives is a conspiracy to control the world. I apologise for spoiling any NWO-related dreams you may have had if you're thinking about private education for your own children. His second bet, I thought, is that there is a way to pretend to be a member of this boarding school Bilderberg group, which will convince actual members, who will then grant him access to the secret world domination plans and let him gain absolute power for himself. His third bet is that the way to accomplish this is to give members the correct signal, like a Masonic handshake. His fourth bet is that the private school Illuminati's equivalent of the Masonic handshake is leaning over like a leering Tower of Pisa and saying, "We know," out loud in front of a non-member, which happens to be the least secret signal I could possibly imagine, aside from actually waving the school wasn't Freemasons flag around on television, screaming that you secretly control global politics. I did not say any of this, of course. Neither did Barty, whom I later learned thought the exact same thing, so perhaps there is something in the idea after all. The rest of the day was a fun and invigorating adventure as we ran around the city seeing show after show. By the time we got back to the hostel, we were all in need of a good night's sleep if we were to have a proper day at the Fringe in the morning. We all settled down to bed to embrace the soothing medicine of rest. The screech of an alley cat being flayed alive while putting gravel into a washing machine and selecting the fastest available spin cycle assaulted me, slamming me to the bed, gripping me in a paralyzing terror. Such was the volume of this conversation between the Banshee Road Drillers and Town Criers Union and the Guantanamo Bay Chamber Choir that I nearly had a heart attack. Reeling from the shock, I located the source of the din, hardly believing that a human being was capable of making such a noise. Was it the gates of hell opening and loosing its demonic hordes upon the world? Or was it truly just Alex snoring like the bastard child of a motorway and a metal gig? Snoring has always been a pet peeve of mine. I cannot help but conceive an instinctive hatred for anyone who snores, especially since they can so easily solve it by sleeping on their side. This snoring was not only the loudest I've ever heard, but also by far the most chaotic. The cement mixer full of boomboxes would shift into an avalanche of radio static in a completely patternless, unpredictable manner, rendering it not even possible to lull yourself to sleep by following any rhythm in his breathing. Too exhausted for conflict, I suffered the entire night in fitful semi-sleep. In the morning, neither I, nor Barty, nor Quentin could get up. None of us had slept a wink, and we were all desperate, clinging to our beds in protest at the coming of the day. This did not stop Alex from leaping about, fully refreshed, crashing about the room with vigour and joy, dressing with malicious intent, and perennially waking us up at the moment any of us finally managed to snatch an instant of sleep. He showed off his rested state, poking fun at us for trying to relieve our dog-tired suffering. "Honestly, why do you lot need so much sleep?" he said with more than a little smug relish. "You're all so lazy. Get up!" The three of us eventually managed to call on some reserve of inner strength and forcibly revived ourselves, making our way out into the city several hours later than we planned. After our first show, we wandered into the Royal Mile, and we were showered with flyers in addition to the rain, given to us by a cornucopia of performers, some dazzling in costume, bristling with wit and panache, others less so, decked simply in their lanyards of office, hired hands from the big venues. We drifted over to the north side of the street and passed a great many souvenir shops on the route uphill, a bevy of tartans and Scottish flags flitting past my right eye. Suddenly, Alex stopped dead in his tracks in front of me and made a show of looking in at one of the windows, perusing the available wares with an expression that seemed to want to look as if it belonged to a connoisseur. Britain's new arbiter of souvenir shop taste suggested we go inside and wandered in before we could reply. Passing a tartan he claimed had once belonged to his family, but it's been lost to history. I'm sure that Clan Smethurst misses it dearly. He made a beeline for a selection of tacky souvenir pocket watches presented in an antique shop-style cabinet, as if that was sufficient to elevate these specimens to the status of jewellery. Alex, wrapped in awe, gingerly took one and inspected it reverentially. The watch face had a clear panel, I don't even think it was glass, that showed a section of cogs beneath. "There's something exquisite about intricate clockwork," he said, and my heart sank. Barty and I tried to appeal to one another through the medium of glances, but this dance of pretense had begun, and it would be danced to the end. Alex had already swollen like a pus-filled boil with pride, and he hadn't even bought it yet. The pocket watch was 40 quid, so it was probably worth about 10. I could see that it was made of hard silver plastic, as Alex slowly made his way to the till, bearing it before him like the Archbishop of Canterbury rehearsing with the crown before the next coronation, with a mixture of intense, oblivious concentration and sacred reverie. Whenever we needed to check the time that day, Alex would immediately get out his pocket watch in an overly theatrical bow, open it and check it, bending far enough over to display the watch face outward to everyone around him, showing off to its rarefied plastic panel of intricate and oh-so-special clockwork in a gesture so massive that it was impossible not to look, no matter how much you didn't want to. When told that the time on his pocket watch was 5 minutes slow, a fact our phones made it easy to verify, he would contradict us with fire in his eyes and sweat on his jowls, despite the fact that we'd missed 2 shows because he'd given us the time. As the day progressed, his actions grew more and more extreme as he began to interrupt shows mid-performance, trying to gain an audience for himself. As the public stared daggers at us, we 3 innocents tried our utmost not to wither in embarrassment. In every pub, he leapt in front of whichever one of us had been leading and deliberately launched himself into the largest, most throne-like chair he could find, his pocket watch cradled in his hand like an orb of state. "It's not my fault you took your eyes off the prize," he'd say, brimming with smug self-satisfaction. At the end of the day, we were tired, hot, and tipsy from drink, and we piled into a cramped taxi to take us back to the hostel. The day's suppressed anger at Alex was mounting in these close quarters. Sweating and on edge, we were trying to focus on the conversation at hand. "It's amazing that the brain is run on electricity," Quentin said. "Yeah, there's enough in there that we can measure its activity," I said. Alex loomed forward into consciousness.
"Just enough," he said,
in the most petulant, passive-aggressive way he could have said it. "Just enough. So what? So what? He was going to try and get one over on me with his own minor little correction that wasn't even true in the first place." My muscles tensed as rage and hatred rose within me, and I thought my blood vessels would burst. I could sense my blood pressure shooting through the roof, fueling my wrath. The heat, the tension, the blood, the testosterone, every rage-filled sinew, all rising with manic hate to fever pitch. "Not just enough," I shouted. "Enough! Just enough!" I was one pinprick away from exploding in a fit of primal and barbarian fury when the taxi door flew open, a gust of cool air washed over me, and we were back at the hostel. As we walked into our room, Barty, Quentin and I, beyond exhausted from our lack of sleep, I took Alex aside. "Alex, you kept us all awake last night with your snoring. Don't do it again, please. It is a testament to my powers of self-control that I was able to mind my P's and Q's at this stage."
"I can't help it,"
he whined pathetically. "Yes, you can. Sleep on your side tonight."
"I can't sleep on my side."
"Sleep on your side," I shouted at him, commanding him in the name of justice. He reluctantly said he'd try, and we went to bed. At first, there was peace. Peace enough to fall asleep and take some long overdue and extremely necessary rest. But then the drums of war began to sound, and the eldritch snore of the deep returned, even stronger and mightier than before. There was only one way to stop it: to wake him up, and keep him up long enough that I could get into a deep enough sleep not to get woken up again. A large water bottle lay at the foot of my bed, and a table stood next to it. Battle commenced! I attacked the table with the water bottle as hard as I could, bashing both sides of the table in a pincer movement to overwhelm his defences. And he woke. I seized the initiative to recapture the balmy, healing pool of sleep. But not 5 seconds passed between Alex waking up and Alex falling back to sleep, his force snoring like an army of lions. Again the bottle struck home. A small patch of calm was desperately won, and again the roar of 1,000 hurricanes sailed forth. On and on through the night, Alex and I duelled for the right to sleep, each of us snatching a fraction of a wink from the other in a war of attrition whose stakes were life and death. The following morning was Alex's last, and the 3 of us looked forward to the prospect of his parents finally removing him from our lives indefinitely. We were going to have a pub lunch, walk up Arthur's Seat, and then Alex's parents would come to our salvation back in the city. It was a conclusion that could not come swiftly enough. As we sat down in the pub, Quentin mentioned that he'd never actually had haggis. I said to him, "Oh, it's nice, it puts fire in your belly." Alex turned to me with a significant look and said, "Really?" And well disposed towards him, due to the knowledge that he was of his impending departure, I told him, "Oh yeah, it really gets you going." Quentin and Alex both plumped for it, while Barty and I ate steak and ale pie. Having lunched, we proceeded to tackle Arthur's Seat. For the uninitiated, Arthur's Seat is an extinct volcano beside Edinburgh. It offers a spot of sublime, rugged landscape beside the urban sprawl of Scotland's capital city. and is subsequently a popular and very well-trodden location for tourists and locals alike. We began our ascent on the easiest path, and as we began to climb, more and more of the city rolled out to my right, with the sounds of police sirens and traffic still audible on the breeze. It was a picturesque scene, but we were still unmistakably within the limits of civilization. As I turned to look ahead of me again, Alex suddenly began to swing his arms wide, striding forward in a full-on march. He turned to Quentin and, thinking I was out of earshot, said, "I'm glad I had the haggis and not the lowly steak and ale pie." Directing the word lowly squarely at Barty and me behind him, he stepped his marching up a gear and we began to move with his full power, trying his hardest to physically dominate the landscape as if he were about to do battle with the gods. The flailing of his body was becoming ever more pronounced as he rocketed forward and, hitting some kind of euphoric state that filled every inch of his body, he screamed to the heavens above at the very top of his lungs so that the entire world might hear and tremble in awe. "I am a 19th century gentleman explorer extraordinaire!" And the pocket watch flew off its chain, shooting far in front of him at breakneck speed like a meteorite, and smashed into the ground, shattering into a million pieces with perfect comic timing. He hit the ground, overcome with shame. "It's the manufacturer's fault," he said with tears in his eyes. In his blind panic, he told us, "We have to go back to the shop before my parents arrive. I can exchange it." Alex is completely destroyed. "I'm extremely persuasive. I'll get him to exchange it. I've got what it takes to make him exchange it." So he dragged us across the city as fast as he could, his sweat and his tears pouring off him in one salty wave of sorrow and shame, fear and despair, pain and exertion. And finally, reaching his destination, he told us to wait outside while he went in and convinced the owner. Peering through the window, I watched Alex, scanning behind him for any witnesses, pay another £40 for a new, identical pocket watch from the shelf. "See? I told you I'm persuasive." He even offered me two pocket watches to compensate me for that manufacturer's defects. But I told him, "I'm a gentleman. I have too much honour." I couldn't be bothered. I just wanted to see him either leave or die. And from a legal perspective, it was fortunate that his parents were almost here. A group of normally dressed, normal-seeming folk met up with us. They had Cockney accents and seemed completely unpretentious, nice and friendly. And it transpired they were Alex's family. He showed them the pocket watch, unravelling his plastic gift shop pearl with his fullest courtly bow time-checking gesture, performed with such ostentatious ceremony and aplomb. It seemed he expected a fanfare from an orchestra to swell around him and eternal prestige to be bestowed upon him from the heavens. His family glanced at it for a second, then simply looked away, uncaring, as tears pooled in the corner of his piggish eyes. As he left that day, I realised that my travels with Alex had fundamentally changed my outlook on life. I am eternally grateful for the trials that he put me and my companions through on those first 3 days of our Edinburgh Fringe trip. At the end of a journey, we find ourselves grown. At the end of a journey, we find ourselves changed. We know, and you, dear reader, should take this lesson too, that no matter how bad life seems to be, no matter how far you may fall, no matter what darkness may overwhelm you or what power may stand against you, no matter how your heart is broken or your dreams brought crashing to the ground, no matter how your life may be in ruins, there is one piece of solace you will always be able to take. You will never, ever be Alexander Smethurst. Thank you very much.
Should have remembered from last time I recorded Chris that he was going to destroy my audio equipment. Oh, thank you very much, Chris. If people would like to get some drinks now or take a bathroom break or whatever, we'll just take a short break and then we'll have Mr. Paul Cornell.
Bristol Con Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the Bristol Con Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.